Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is James H. Ottaway, Jr. Jim Ottaway, Jr. retired as senior vice president of Dow Jones & Company, Inc. on December 31st, 2003, and retired from its board of directors on April 19th, 2006. Mr. Ottaway retired on April 1st, 2003, as chairman of Ottaway Newspapers Incorporated, Campbell Hall, New York, the community newspaper subsidiary of Dow Jones & Company, Incorporated, after 43 years' work in various positions. He also retired as chairman of the World Press Freedom Committee, based in Reston, Virginia, on April 2, 2006. Born in Binghamton, New York, on March 24, 1938, Mr. Ottaway is a graduate of Phillips Exeter Academy, 1955, and from Yale University with a BA in 1960. While at Yale, he was chairman editor of the Yale Daily News from 1959 to 1960. Jim Ottaway began his career with Ottaway Newspapers as a reporter, continued in the field as an associate editor in Danbury, Connecticut, for the News Times from 1960 to 1962. A reporter, bureau chief, State House correspondent, and management trainee for the Times Herald Record in Middletown, New York, from 1962 to 1963. Editor of the Pocono Record, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, from 1963 to 1965, publisher in New Bedford, Massachusetts, of the Standard Times, from 1965 to 1970, Jim Ottaway became president director of Ottaway Newspapers upon its merger with Dow Jones on August 1, 1970, and chairman of the board upon the retirement of his father, James H. Ottaway, Sr., on July 31, 1979. Mr. Ottaway is also a former member of Doctors Without Borders, U.S. Advisory Board, the Human Rights Watch USA, New York City Council, member of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, former board member and treasurer, International Center for Transitional Justice, board member of Human Rights in China, and former member of the Board of Trustees and chairman of the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, and former chairman of the Board of Words Without Borders, the international literary website. Currently, Jim Ottaway is a trustee and chairman of the Storm King Art Center, a life trustee at Bard College, and chairman of its Institute for International Liberal Education Advisory Board. He's also treasurer of Walkill Valley Land Trust, Incorporated. Jim Ottaway has honorary degrees, including Doctor of Journalism from Suffolk University, Boston, 1970, Doctor of Business Administration, Southeastern Massachusetts University, South Dartmouth, Massachusetts, 1984. Jim Ottaway is married to Mary Hyde, has three children, and has lived in New Paltz, New York, since 1984. Jim Ottaway, a great hero of mine, I'll be perfectly honest. I shouldn't appear fawning, but I am, because you have done such magnificent things for so many people. Let's start from the beginning. You were born into a distinguished journalistic family. How has that affected you?
Well, newspapers were my life. As young as 6 years old, I found while going through my mother's papers when she died at 101 2 years ago, she'd saved a copy of a little newspaper I made in 1945, where I must have been homesick, and I would clip out headlines from the newspaper. My father's local paper was the Endicott Daily Bulletin, Endicott, New York, upstate.
Is that where you were, in Endicott?
I grew up in Endicott.
Interesting.
Little town actually called Endwell, New York.
Well, those of us who know a little bit about Binghamton also know about Johnson City and Endicott.
Exactly. the triple cities, still there. So I found this little paper, and I even wrote a little editorial in it about the rising price of turkeys that was going to be a problem for the mothers cooking for Thanksgiving dinner. This was 1945. I was born in 38, so I was 6 years old. You can see the bug was in me early. As soon as I could carry a bag, my father had me delivering newspapers, Route 101 in Endwell, New York. I found in my mother's incredible collection of family historical items a little bag that I used to collect, put my coins in when I went around Saturday mornings collecting money for the newspaper. So I learned to be a little businessman early on when child labor was legal. And newspapers were delivered by kids who were actually independent contractors. I bought the papers from the newspaper for 5 cents, and I sold them for 7 cents. And I was no benefits, no pension plan, none of that. All that's ancient history now. So I got very early interested in that. As soon as I could write a story, when I was 16, I worked summers in the Endicott Bulletin as a reporter. Found that being a reporter was a wonderful passport for my curious mind to go around asking people any question I wanted to. Mm. if it had to do with the story of some legitimate subject of public interest. It was like a passport to learning, lifelong learning. And I had a curious mind, and this kept me going, writing interesting stories, or at least interesting to me, and the editor enough to run them. So quite early on, I was doing reporting for a local daily newspaper.
What was your relationship with your father like?
He was very clever, bringing me up, wanting me to be in the newspaper business, wanting my brother and sister also. We all were introduced to summer jobs. But he was never pressured me about it or insisted we do it. He just laid it out and said, here's an opportunity, give it a try, maybe you'll like it. And he was so incredibly cool in the later years. It wasn't until I was getting out of college that he said, would you like to come and work in one of our newspapers? I thought, Mr. Cool himself. Here is a private family company, depending on either me or my brother or sister coming into the business for some succession. And he was so psychologically clever that he never pressured any of us. I did this because I'd fallen in love with it by then. It was too much fun not to do.
What'd you call your father?
Father.
Call him Father.
Father, Dad. Our closest relationships were actually playing golf.
Interesting.
Summertime playing golf. A common sport.
Was he competitive?
Yeah, he was a very good golfer. Very unorthodox in everything he did. Very strange golf swing no one could replicate. He danced in a wild way with my mother. And his mind was always, he was breaking through a lot of barriers in early days in newspaper design and ways of doing things, ways of treating people. Great believer in good human relations with all the employees, knew everybody's name, danced with everybody at the annual party. Wives, that is. And he could have been a senator, he's the sort of person who could have run for office because he had he was a great campaigner in the way he does talk to everybody. It would embarrass my mother and us as children as we grew up when he would just, talk to anybody anywhere, anytime while we're trying to do something else. So he was quite a character, wonderful man.
What have you inherited from him? In other words, if you said, what characteristics of my father do I think I have?
That's a really interesting question, tough one. I think one that informed my professional life most was this concern for helping other people do their jobs well. That if you helped even ordinary people with encouragement and a pat on the back and that's a great story or you sold a good ad, that ordinary people could do extraordinary things in a small town newspaper. He'd never read a business book or went to business school. This just came naturally to him as a way of doing business and treating people. And he loved it. It was not something he had to make a big effort to do. And my job was to, as the company got bigger and I became the chairman, was to kind of spread that ethic throughout what was once a 21 newspaper group. And help a lot of people have a good life, enjoy the job, and put out a good newspaper. It was fun.
How did the empire grow?
Well, he had the theory that you would buy a newspaper. First one I recall after this little Endicott Daily Bulletin was Oneonta, New York, then Plattsburgh, New York.
Both where WAMC has radio stations.
Yes. I often hear you interviewing Jim Dinko in Plattsburgh or the editor in Oneonta. These are people I've worked with for years. So he would make some money, borrow some money. One of his rules was you go to a bank and you borrow money when you don't need it. Then you would be ready for the next acquisition. So his idea was to build a company of more and more local daily newspapers, buy them from families, mostly older people ready to retire, wanted to sell the paper to someone they hoped would do a good job with it. It was like selling their children. It was a very personal business in those days. You had to convince a person that you were going to treat their employees well and their community well, and you'd make a better newspaper whenever you could. So that was the business. Build by buying a new newspaper, pouring back the money always into the business. Though I remember that just before we sold the company to Dow Jones in 1970, the total dividends for the whole family were $60,000.
Meaning you didn't take a lot out?
We didn't take hardly anything out. That's for five people. Kids getting a lot less, of course. It was all plowed back into the business. And particularly in Middletown, New York, when he purchased originally the Times Herald, an old daily newspaper, printed on a letterpress, hot type, old-fashioned in Middletown in 1956. And then in 1959 managed to buy a competing newspaper, The Record, a offset tabloid first and for years the largest daily newspaper printed on an offset press in America, It was started in Middletown, New York. And, of course, these two papers of about 20,000 circulation were fighting each other, both losing money. And he managed to get the owner of the new record, who was Jack Kaplan of the Kaplan Foundation, to sell the paper to him because they didn't both want to go on losing money forever. And my father was in the newspaper business, and Kaplan had made his money buying and selling grape juice cooperatives.
Welch's grape juice. And our wonderful Joan, of course.
And you know Joan Davidson is his daughter and a wonderful human being. Great asset in the Hudson Valley.
So I take it one's word becomes very important, keeping one's word. He told them that he would honor their traditions, and he did.
Yes, that was very important to all of us. Making a pledge like that, you really have to keep it.
Well, there are people who have made pledges and haven't kept them.
That's true, too.
Just take 1 second to explain, because there are some people who may not know what an offset press is compared to hot type. You want to tell us about that?
Well, the old traditional, it was called hot type because it was based on molten lead.
Sure.
Where you set each line of type, as you read it in the paper, on a little piece of lead with the raised letters on it. Rather dangerous system to manage this hot molten lead you had to pour and then cool it down into plates. They were put on a big mechanical press, and the plates would hit up against the ink roller, and then they would hit the paper on an impact, printing by impact, ink onto the paper. Offset press was all based, instead of on molten lead, on photography. You took a picture of the page, you printed it on a thin aluminum plate instead of a heavy, big lead plate, and then you put it on an equally heavy press with print ink rollers, offsetting. Instead of printing directly on the plate, they printed onto a second roller and then onto the paper, and it was a kiss instead of a wallop that got the ink on the paper. Much cleaner. And the other great advantage was you could print much sharper photography, much bigger pictures.
Absolutely.
When the Middletown Record down in Orange County started in 1956, its main competitive advantage was much sharper and good-looking pictures of the people you're trying to show in the paper every day. That was a big advantage. Plus, cleaner hands. After you'd finished reading the paper, your hands weren't dirty. Now, every paper in America is offset.
Oh, absolutely.
And your hands aren't as dirty as they used to be.
I was a publisher once. I was a publisher, well, I am, the Legislative Gazette. But before that, way before that, as a young man, right out of graduate school, I published the alternative newspaper of Fire Island called the Fire Island Sun. And we went to Farmingdale, New York, where there was the first of these offset places, and we'd stay there till 2 o'clock and take a water taxi back with the papers the next day. So I remember, and we had competition, and the competition immediately switched from hot type to offset.
We were
part of the revolution, right? Okay, so how did you sort of get taken along by your father into each of these positions? Give us a little biography.
Well, his main training philosophy was not to work with him.
Interesting.
I've spent very little time working with him. It would always be learn from this editor or that businessman or this printer. And the main management training system that he had developed was for not just me, but anyone who was going to be a manager, to work in every department in the paper. Sell a newspaper on the street, sell an advertising, an ad for the paper, wipe the press to get the ink off at the end of the day, work in the composing room. If you're going to manage the business, you should know how it works. So I had a very nitty-gritty training, and first in hot type in Danbury, Connecticut at the News Times, my first job after Yale, where I was editor of the Yale Daily News. That was my journalism school,
wow,
so to speak.
Well, that's impressive.
That was like a 40-hour a week job.
Well, think of all the brains that were there, and you get to be the editor. That's pretty good. Did you have to fight for that?
No, I had to be talked into it.
Oh, is that right?
Because I was about to get married to Mary.
Yeah.
Between my junior and senior year, and I thought, this is going to be a very hectic year if I'm editor of the paper in my first year of marriage.
Talk to us a little about Mary Ann, a wonderful woman. How did you meet up?
Blind date at Vassar. She was at Vassar studying Greek. I was at Yale studying history, the arts, and letters in Europe. My roommate spotted her at a sort of a mixer, came back, and he said, Ottaway, I've seen a goddess. You've got to meet her. And I did. He set up a date for me, actually. And I went over in my Jeep to Vassar, which was a hand-me-down white Jeep with a big red star on the side. This is 1957, not too long after McCarthy. It looked like a Russian Jeep.
From New Haven to...
From New Haven to, yeah. Over to Poughkeepsie.
Yeah.
And we called up to her room and said, come on down, we're going out for a drink, and, you know, you should meet this guy. And she had some paper due, and then she looked out the window. She said, I saw this funny-looking car, Jeep with a red star. I thought, that guy must be interesting. So that's how she at least came on the date. And I started going to Vassar every weekend for 2 years almost. And when she graduated a year ahead of me, I thought she was going to go to Greece to be an archaeologist. I thought, if she goes to Greece this summer, I'll never see her again. I better ask her now to get married.
Interesting.
And our parents were very cooperative, helped us pay the rent. First year, $90 a week. Month. $90 a month on a fourth floor walk-up in New Haven, right across from the Yale Art Gallery, and about a half a block from the Yale Daily News. So we had a strategic location. And she had the great fun of going into morning class, sneaking into, literally, into a morning class with a man named Bernard Knox, who was a great classical philosopher teaching at Yale at the time, reading Greek plays using the Greek she'd learned at Vassar. And it was a real idyllic first year.
Did he know that she was a ringer?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Everyone else was men. There were no girls at Yale at that point.
Of course.
This was 1959-60.
Who else was prominent we've come to know today? You know, I know the Bushes were there at different times. Who was there when you were there that you could name?
Well, the future president of Yale, Bart Giamatti, was in my
class.
Oh,
indeed.
Mm-hmm. A guy named Les Aspin became the
congressman,
and then Secretary of Defense. He was in my class. David Holbrook, a roommate, became the head of Marsh McLuhan Insurance Company in the U.S.
Looking back on Yale,
yeah.
Is it your sense that it's an elitist institution which trains the best and brightest in the country?
Well, it's elitist in the sense that it's very hard to get into. It's meritocracy, though. Today, if you can have an income up to, I think it's $100,000, and go up free of charge almost. The tuition free. They have such a huge endowment.
Yale's always been good about that.
Well, they've been good, but in recent years, even better. It wasn't until the last 5 years that this kind of needs-blind admission was taken up by the Ivy League, some of the Ivy Leagues that could afford it. So now it's almost a roulette wheel of people who all have 800s in their SAT exams, math and English, and have done well in the writing. And they turn down more people with the 800s than they accept. Something like 22,000 people apply, and they accept for the freshman class about 1,000. So but this is true at Harvard, too. I mean, it's not...
It's true. But what do you make of that? I'm not being critical. I mean, no. What do you make of that? Do you think that that's healthy? I mean, that there aren't people who are very aggressive, who will do very well, who never would approach anything like an 800 score and do well in life?
Oh, obviously, that's true. Not everybody running the world is went to Yale or Harvard. What Mary and I discovered living in small newspaper towns, our early life was working in Danbury, Connecticut, Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, paper that we had there, 10,000 circulation. I was the editor at 25. Middletown, New York, and New Bedford, Massachusetts, was that in every case there was a community college or a state college like SUNY New Paltz nearby, and Mary would go and take courses. And she always found great teachers who were as good as people she had at Vassar or I had at Yale, who just didn't happen to have published three great books that you have to have. You know, you have to publish or perish if you're going to be teaching at Harvard or Yale, Princeton, and the rest.
Or even New Paltz these days.
Yeah, or New Paltz. I mean, that pressure's on, that's a good point. That pressure's on scholars everywhere who are teaching. But we learned the basic fact that there's so many great teachers in America that there are many good colleges which may not have the greatest, you know, Ivy League reputations, but are giving you the usually better teaching than you get at the big universities, because there's more focus on teaching and less on the pressure of getting grants from the government to do science research, and much more attention paid to the students, which I liked about Yale. Their teaching there was much more important than it ever was at Harvard. So it's a better place to be if you're for a student.
So noted.
To get in, you have to win the roulette wheel game.
Well, you've been, I don't want to take you off track, but you've been wonderful to SUNY at New Paltz. You live in New Paltz, but you bring a scholar every year to teach there and lecture series, and you've been extremely supportive. Why?
Well, you can see that I think education is really important for everybody. And there are many bright students coming from SUNY New Paltz and many other places in the country who will do well and make major contributions or be really good citizens. You don't have to run the world to be, you know, to be important. And in a democracy, everyone is important. And everyone should be, well, as educated as possible, as curious as possible about what's going on, as interested in listening to news on NPR and WAMC, as to be good citizens. It's we have to educate everyone or we can't function in a democracy.
Well, I ask you that because, you know, every once in a while I'll talk to somebody and they'll say, where did you spend your career teaching? And I'll say New Paltz, and they'll say, oh, you know. I love that institution.
That is a sign of their ignorance.
Yes, it is. I love that institution.
There are many good teachers. They're really first-rate people.
Yeah.
It's a great town to live in, too, because they make it a lively place.
Jim Onaway, what's happened to newspapers? I was so struck as you spoke about your father's philosophy of acquisition. Mm-hmm. And he was there at the right time, obviously.
Oh, we were in the glory days of newspapers.
Right. Now we have something else going on. Can you tell us about it? What's happening?
Well, some numbers that hit you in the eye when you talk about what's happened to the newspaper business. 10 years ago, 2002, all the newspapers in America, there were about 1,400, had total advertising revenues of $44 billion. It was bigger than almost any other advertising source. 10 years later, 2012, there's been an implosion in advertising, a huge decline. Last year, 2012, the total ad revenues, I checked this with the Newspaper Advertising Bureau, were $22.6 billion, almost exactly half what they were 10 years ago.
And that's in
newspaper
dollar
advertising.
That's dollar to dollar, because we know that the dollars are worth.
Right, and it's, you know, it's an inflated dollar, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
So it's even tougher. The result is there are about a third fewer reporters in America than there were 10 years ago.
Sure.
I think this is a disaster for our society.
Sure.
I can talk about that.
I want you to.
Because fewer public bodies are being covered by reporters. When I was a kid reporter in Middletown, 1962, and one night I would cover a school board in Chester, a zoning board in Florida, and maybe a planning board in Warwick, and send in, you know, short stories, but people would know what's going on in their town. Now many of these boards just don't get covered.
Sure.
I used to sit in a courthouse in Goshen. I remember covering my first double murder trial. I sat there for about a week covering a murder trial. It was great stories, great copy and all that. But I don't think we cover the courts anymore there. We don't have enough reporters. The Middletown Record has about half as many reporters today as it had 10 years ago. Many papers, the reporting staff is down much more than 33%. Los Angeles Times, I used to have 1,000, now they have 400. The New York Times has 1,000 people on its editorial staff. I heard Arthur Sulzberger talk about this. By the way, he's a Hudson Valley resident.
I know that.
New Paltz on the weekends, comes up to rock climb and get away from it all. The devastation of the newspaper newsrooms has a ripple effect into our society that most people don't realize, because it means there's fewer people doing the original reporting on the scene. And while the Associated Press makes up for that to some extent in Albany, and it doesn't cover Middletown. It just can't. You have to look to the local newspapers for doing this. Weekly newspapers continue to do this quite well. There's a kind of an inverse ratio of economic decline. The smaller the paper, the healthier it is financially. The bigger, until you get to the New York Times, which Arthur says is making some money, Wall Street Journal, which I think is about breaking even, Washington Post, which is not making money. Papers below that are losing circulation and are in bankruptcy.
Indeed.
Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, Hartford Courant, they're all in bankruptcy.
The parent company of the Kingston Freeman.
Yes. So there's a kind of a disaster going on in the original reporting of news from newspaper reporters in America that you see it in a thinner paper because there's a little less advertising, but you don't notice the things you don't know happened but you didn't know about. You can't see what's not there. And there's a lot of not there that used to be in newspapers, and that as an old-fashioned newspaper reporter, really bothers me. I think it's really bad for our society.
I used to say to my students, what else was happening the day Kennedy was shot? They say, you'll never know. Right. And that's right. Your point.
That old watchdog function of local newspapers, which is so important to a democracy, the so-called fourth estate, watching the legislative and the judicial and the executive, has been seriously weakened by the decline of advertising.
Now, there are those who will say that there are more eyeballs now than ever because of the web. Mm-hmm. I know, Jim Ottaway, you have made a point of saying something that is really profound. Somebody's got to pay for all of this. And the real question is, do you buy it? Do you buy the fact that with everybody having a blog and the web and all the rest of it, that that makes up for what newspapers used to do?
It does in some places and in some ways, but not totally. In some places, because there are about 400 new news websites that have popped up across the country. I've been following that as an interesting thing that I'm interested in. The Columbia Journalism Review, which is a media criticism, a very good website, by the way, cjr.org, has a very sharp business news audit, it's called, critique of business news coverage, has a very sharp criticism of medical reporting, which is quite bad in many aspects in America. You know, we're told every day that one thing is good that was bad yesterday and it's good the next day, and have olive oil today and chocolate tomorrow. a lot of thin reporting on medicine. They critique that. That's a kind of website that has grown up in recent days. But I'm thinking more of basic news coverage in communities that have lost their newspapers. Something like that has happened right in Hudson Valley with Watershed Post. Just two women and their baby and their dog and in their kitchen, producing an amazing amount of news and stories with people calling in, getting some contributions, some advertising. I think they're setting a, websites like that are setting a new model of a kind of new business model that includes contributions, advertising, promotional events where you can raise money, and a lot of volunteer help. People calling in with stories or sending in videos. During the big storm of Irene of August of 2011, at one point they had 60,000 people calling in to say, is my road still open? Is my mom okay? How can I get, what stores are open? I mean, they served a vital purpose in a crisis that newspapers used to, daily newspapers, where you could call in and find out what's happening, or local radio stations used to, before they gave up news. There's another disaster in the news business. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, we used to have three radio stations in the Ottaway Group, one in Cape Cod, one in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and where was the other? Oneonta, WDOS. And they had at least two news reporters doing hourly news reports of some kind. Now you can't find a radio station in America that has a local news coverage, if any news at all. Thank God for National Public Radio. What you work for is a really important part of our society today, because something like 2,000 radio stations are out there and with no news. You're the only source of serious news today in most communities, particularly small communities in America, and I really respect what you're doing. I think it's really vital.
I want to talk to you a little bit about, go back to your career path, which is so interesting. There came this humongous fight over Dow Jones. Your family were prominent. You basically were top dog there for a while. And along comes Rupert Murdoch. And a lot of people were ready to sell Dow Jones and to sell out. And you really put up a huge fight, for which you became famous and beloved, against Murdoch. But in the end, the family wanted to do it, and you did it. So I guess the number one question you probably get, in the same way I get, how come Mario Cuomo didn't run for president? The number one question you probably get is, has Murdoch, who said he would leave the Wall Street Journal alone, and has he kept his word?
In a strange way, and quite unexpectedly and pleasantly, a pleasant surprise to me, while he's taken a big interest in it, he has not ruined it, which I thought he might. My criticisms of Murdoch were totally based on factual evidence, things he had done before, when he made promises to Dorothy Schiff of the liberal, union-oriented New York Post that he would keep it that way. And now we have the New York Post of today, very conservative, right-wing. Great headlines, but, yep. You know, attack your enemies and support your friends and kind of journalism that I abhor. And don't think it's entertainment, but it's not a great public service. And when he bought the Times of London, he promised Harry, he signed a contract with Harry Evans, a guy I've come to know since, who was going to be editor of the Times of London for the rest of his life. And he was gone in 1 year. He's made promises one after another and not kept them. Now, I spoke from his offer came in May 1st of 2007, and the final collapse of the resistance came in sometime in September after he said, if I don't have 50% of the Bancroft family votes, so this was the controlling, we only had 7% of the votes.
We meaning the
Ottaway family.
Yes.
70% of the votes were held by the Bancroft family, so the issue was what would happen there. And they had three branches fighting with each other, and it was they eventually split so far that he got more than half of those votes, and then he had succeeded. But what he said was, during this whole summer of my pointing out the bad things that would happen if he purchased the Dow Jones and ran the Wall Street Journal, just by citing history, never using any adjectives, just history. No dirty words, no nastiness about it, just factual statements. He had one answer, and it was very clever. He said, why would I spend $6 billion to buy Dow Jones and then proceed to ruin the Wall Street Journal, its main asset? And in fact, he hasn't ruined it. While he calls the editor, who's told me this several, often, to talk about politics, he doesn't tell him what to say or write because they agree in the first place. The Wall Street Journal editorial page is very compatible with his conservative.
Oh, he's been a conservative editorial page, yeah.
He didn't have to change that. He might have changed the news sections to be all, attacking his enemies and supporting his friends and only reporting on his ideas. That hasn't happened. There have been instances where the reporters have complained about a little pressure here and there. But he hasn't laid off a lot of them. He's added some. He did an amazing thing in the fall of 2010, I think it was, where they added 6 or 8 pages of book reviews on Saturdays that are first-rate, sharp, written by really expert people, lively topics, but it's about books and ideas. 6 or 8 pages, no new advertising. Totally, on one hand, public service to the reader. On the other hand, a sharp attack and a competitive war that he sees himself in with the New York Times.
I wanted to ask you about that. Can you proceed on that? Because there were a lot of people who said, with some evidence that he really wanted to put the New York Times out of business.
Oh, he said he wanted to.
Yeah.
He wrote a letter to Arthur Sulzberger that Arthur told me about saying, let the battle begin.
Yeah.
No, he's a very competitive guy. And, in a way, thank God he loves newspapers.
Yeah.
He's going to keep the Journal going as long as he can. It's now being spun off into a newspaper division of separate company from the News Corp Entertainment groups, Fox TV and Channel and Films and all that. So that'll make it a little weaker support. But he's an old-fashioned newspaper man. I might not like his journalism, but he's tried to keep newspapers going.
Have you had any face-to-face with him individually?
No, I never met him. No.
Interesting.
Never met him. I mean, he obviously didn't want to meet me. But I must say, he kept the Ottaway papers that were then left. They were down to 7 by then because Dow Jones had sold off some. And he's treated them with a kind of benign neglect, which is actually good for them.
Well, they say that he loses a lot of money on the New York Post. Why would anybody do that?
Because he loves newspapers, and I think he has fun with it.
Yeah.
I think it's a kind of an amusement for him. Maybe he sees it from his point of view as a public service, advancing a kind of ideas that need to be stated in a liberal city like New York City. I think he sees that as a kind of a mission. He's interested in ideas and politics as well as making money.
He got into terrible trouble in Great Britain to the point that, his subordinates have been arrested, taken in, all the rest of it. But that has not jumped the pond, as we say, has it? That trouble.
Yes, I wonder whether it won't someday. There is, for a company like News Corp, which is legally an American company based in New York,
right,
is subject to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Yeah.
I think sooner or later something's got to come up, or you'd think would have to come up, challenging the company from this side of the pond because of the truly horrendous things that his people and their papers did in London, you know, threatening people with stories if they didn't give him news about other people. You know, really nasty stuff. Paying the police for stories before someone else got them. You know, things we wouldn't think of doing in America. And so far, no one's found the New York Post doing that, but you wonder how they're...
Well, but if this corporation owned the British papers, it's an American corporation, then I agree with you. I've said it a number of times. Wouldn't it stand to reason that the Corrupt Foreign Act would take hold here? Wouldn't it have happened already, is my question. Or is he just too powerful to take on? Nobody wants to do it.
That's a possibility. And the other thing is it's not politically popular thing to do. And the other possibility is they're waiting to see the outcome of the court cases
there.
The
British trials, yes.
And then they'd have an even stronger case, maybe.
Yeah. So I wanted to say there's another side to you, and that other side is that you have a lot of interests. You're an environmentalist, I know that, and you have an interest in something called Storm King. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the Storm King Art Center had its 50th anniversary in 2010. It's one of the top two or three outdoor sculpture garden museums of modern sculpture in the world. You know, it's really a world-class place of where the unique beauty of it is that you're seeing large outdoor sculpture, some indoors, but mostly large and some small outdoor sculpture in a beautiful landscape that incidentally was created by moving a lot of earth up to make the New York Thruway that goes right by it.
Fascinating.
There's a sign now that says Storm King Art Center as you go north, right as you pass it. Now, so it just got up last year. So it's really a unique place. When my wife and I were living in Goshen, we moved there in 1970, as part of the purchase by Dow Jones of our family company, I had to become president of the Ottaway newspapers and come. I was sort of part of that, hostage in that deal. And I had to move to Goshen and work at our headquarters in Campbell Hall, New York. We used to quite often take our children when they were 4, 6, 8, 10 to Storm King for picnics on the weekends. So you could say I've been going there for 40 years. I got on the board about 20 years ago and was vice chairman until recently when Peter Stern, the chairman for 50 years, who did a marvelous job of building it up and working with individual artists in a very unusual way I can tell you about. He's had gotten into fairly late stages of Alzheimer's and had to retire from running the place. And luckily, his son was willing to come back from Verizon, where he was a top lawyer, to pick up the traces, and he's the president. I'm just the non-executive chairman of the Board of Trustees. Very interested, but not in the day-to-day operation. So we open around May 3rd or 4th till December 1st each year. And since John has been the president, our visitation has gone from about almost double to 80,000 people a year, summer. And we are every year have a special exhibit of people we think are interesting up-and-coming sculptures. And two most popular things we did in recent years were the Andy Galsworthy wall that went for a walk, it's called. It goes winding through some trees and down under a pond and up toward the thruway. You can see it from the thruway, actually. That's one popular, an Englishman from the Midlands of England, and Andy Galsworthy. And the other was the Maya Lin Wave Field, which is on about 4 acres of land, but set in about 7 or 8 acres. Of 7 big waves. They're 10 to 14 feet high. You get lost walking between them. The grass grows over them all. It's an outdoor installation set in a way that it makes it almost echo the hills around Storm King itself. Very beautiful thing, and lots of people came to see that and have kept coming since as additional visitors. But we have another major thing we did recently was the Mark de Souvereau has 7 or 8 pieces at the Storm King Art Center because we have so much space. 500 acres, an aesthetic principle that you don't jam things up. They all have a lot of room around them to breathe and stand alone. 2 summers ago, he put up 13 of his big, these are I-beam steel sculptures that you've seen in New York City off and on in public spaces. 13 of them were put up around the Governor's Island. the southern part of Governor's Island. And that had 800,000 visitors over two summers.
Yeah.
They're now being taken down, and some of his works are going to be shown in San Francisco this May.
That's cost a lot of money to run a place like that.
It does cost a lot of money. It takes a lot of fundraising. Thank God we have artists and collectors who are interested. First, the artists are interested in showing there because it's like one of the great stages for public outdoor art. They'll often work with us for a lesser fee than they would somewhere to a private collector because they're getting a huge benefit from all the publicity. But even more important, Peter Stern over the years and John now and David Collins, the artistic director of the Storm King for 36 years, who worked with Peter Stern all those years, they will bring someone like Richard Serra and say, we would like you to do a piece for Storm King. And the way he would work with Richard Serra and also with Osamu Noguchi was to walk the land and let the artist decide what he would like to do in what space. So Serra said, I'd like this field in the southern end of the campus here, and he put these very strong Corten steel, 2-inch thick plates right into the earth in a very jagged way. And it's a beautiful thing the way he did it. Probably wouldn't have happened if he hadn't had the freedom of the canvas, so to speak, to paint his idea onto the landscape. Noguchi did that right behind the building where you go up to on the top of the, when you come to Storm King, there's a kind of a central house on top of the hill. Outside it in the back is the original collection of David Smith metal, polished metal, mostly pieces of metalwork done when it was a breakthrough new idea back in the 1960s. And Ralph Ogden, Peter Stern's father-in-law, and Peter started this site in 1960 as an outdoor sculpture garden with the David Smith collection of about 13 pieces. But since then, right near these David Smiths is this wonderful Isamu Noguchi marble Momotara. And it's a peach pit open with a little hole where the pit would have been. And it's all based on a Japanese fairy tale about the child who was born out of this peach pit to two old people. And children often just get into it, like not even knowing the story. Peter Stern told me that when he was talking to Noguchi, they walked out in the back, and Noguchi said, well, what could you build me a hill right here? And they just built a hill for Noguchi to put this on top. And now it's a very popular, often used by children, major work of art in the collection.
I always thought that the inside of a peach pit was arsenic.
That was carefully removed.
So tell me about art museums in general. I know you have a theory, which is that they are as important as anything else in this world.
Well, maybe not quite that, but the theory, which I must say has been quite well articulated by another Hudson River person, you may have heard of Alex Melamed, a crazy Russian artist who came here and back in the early 80s, I think it was. He lives and has quite a big studio in Hudson. People who are interested in that. He's made some of his speeches about this, which the thesis is two things. If you go to a community, any place in the world, and look around and see what is the largest building, what have people put their most of their time, money, and effort into building, and therefore it holds importance for them as a social connection to everyone and a creation of meaning in every community. And in American towns, in the past, it might be the church, it might be the school building, the high school, maybe the library, and sometimes the biggest business, because we're a commercial country, of course. But in the last 20 years or so, huge amounts of money have been put into building new art museums across the landscape of America. And I've kept a little file of, some of them. One of the biggest, of course, is the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, which is to me a kind of a Athenian Acropolis of our country. It stands up way up over Los Angeles in a majestic way. It's a gorgeous place. That costs, I don't know how many, $500 million or something, a huge amount of money. Frank Gehry built the Bilbao Museum in Spain. That's not in the U.S., but the principle there was we need something really dramatic to change this broken down old industrial city. Let's have a big museum and get a world-class architect. And it's worked. Bilbao is on the map now. People flock there. It's a beautiful place. I've been to see it. It's quite a dramatic thing. And in some version of that has happened with Renzo Piano, the architect, building the Broad Contemporary Art Museum in Los Angeles, the High Museum in Atlanta, David Libeskind doing the Denver Art Museum, dramatic building right in the downtown. And usually these are major statements of what's important to this community. They're downtown.
So it has contemporary meaning, but also when the astronauts land here a million years from now, this is going to be the new anthropology, isn't it?
People will say, what were these buildings for? Somebody must have thought art was important. And there are major art museums now. You know, the Walmart family built this huge museum in Bentonville, Arkansas, middle of nowhere, you know, from our point of view. But it's the largest museum of strictly American art in America. You have to go to Bentonville, Arkansas for that. Toledo, Boston, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, St. Louis. All these cities have new art museums. Why is this? So Melamed's theory is that in an increasingly secular period of history, with the established religions under decline in most cases, at least on the east and west coast of America, outside the Bible Belt, people look for spiritual, still have a spiritual need, a need for spiritual expression and experience. And when you don't get it from prayer, from going to church regularly, from talking to your pastor, priest, or rabbi, you look for it in other places. And one of them is the art world. People looking at beautiful works of art and being inspired.
And or being repulsed.
Or you may be repulsed as well, but you're forced to think about what you think is beautiful. Why do other people think this is worth putting up? You know, it makes you, it's a very, it's an intellectual experience as well as an emotional and spiritual experience. But if you love it, it has a strong quality of the spiritual. And at Storm King, you are overwhelmed by this combination of beautiful sculpture. Most of it is not grim, gritty stuff you can't understand or appreciate. You feel an immediate attraction to it in a beautiful landscape.
And where is Storm King next to?
Well, it's in Cornwall, town of Cornwall, south of Newburgh, north of Harriman. You get off at the New York Thruway and go up Route 32. It's off Route 32. Mountainville, New York is the technical place if you're putting it on your GPS search map system, Mountainville. And the website is stormking.org. or stormkingartcenter.org if you're looking for, you know, they have all sorts of events. They have some really fun events that you might not expect to find in an outdoor museum.
Now, Jim Monaway, we only have 3 minutes left, so okay. I wanted to ask you really quickly, as a New Paltz faculty member of 40 years or so, we're very grateful for what you've done at New Paltz and the Ottaway Fellows. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when my father died, I thought it would be nice to do something in our own community to keep his memory and his flame of interest in good journalism going. And because SUNY New Paltz has quite a large, one of the biggest journalism programs in the country, in New York State, thanks to you from early days, you certainly contributed to that. I think there are 500 or 600 students taking journalism courses.
You think
there.
That's a mistake? Yeah, after all, there are fewer and fewer jobs, as you pointed out earlier in this interview, and yet we find so many kids want to do it.
There's a lot of interest and idealism about journalism and about telling the truth in some way and changing the world for the better. And journalism is one way you can do that. And even though jobs are shrinking in the print media, they're growing on all these new websites and on places like, the Wall Street Journal. While they're shrinking maybe a few fewer print reporters, they're three times as many reporters on the website than they used to have. So there are jobs in the internet world of news. But beyond that, I used to be on an accreditation committee where I'd go around to journalism schools and I'd ask students, why are you taking these courses? They said, we get the best writing teaching in the journalism department because we have to write all the time and we get serious criticism, much better than we get from our English professors who are interested in literary ideas, not correcting our papers.
Sure. The Legislative Gazette newspaper, which I run from New Paltz, out of New Paltz, those young people, it's not a matter of turning in another piece of dreck. You know, they're going to be held responsible for every word they write, and they know it.
Right.
And so your point is well taken.
There's hell to pay if you make a bad mistake. That's true.
It's true.
So I thought it was worth bringing professors as models to all these students to see visiting professors, people in the active profession, many of them Pulitzer Prize winners, who come and teach for anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months if they can get a whole semester off. And they've been quite popular on the campus, and they themselves have a great time doing this.
So they come for one semester, and some of them would like to stay. I know that.
Yeah, that's true. Some of them have bought houses nearby.
Right. They never go. Well, you know, New Paltz is one of those institutions that time never forgot. And, you know, that people come and then they stay forever in that community. It's very, very interesting.
Because it's beautiful and there are a lot of interesting people there.
There are. And it sets the trend. I remember when the young mayor decided he was going to start marrying gay couples and got hell for it. But now look at what's happened. I mean, you know, it's where we should be.
We did it first.
We did. Well, James Ottaway, it's so wonderful to have you here. You've always been a great favorite of mine. Our guest, for all of you who've been listening, has been James Ottaway. I'm Alan Shartok. Thank you for joining us, and I can tell you one thing. This will not be the last hour we do with James Ottaway, because it was just not enough time.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.